still all going to have different accomplishment levels, so
yeah.
You'll still be able to grade us.
Yeah, and see, the way I see this stuff, I mean, once we got past Chapter 4, everything was applications. And so everything after that, you should be able to read on your own and do some stuff with. And I'm going through Chapter 5 in more detail because, you know, this is when it's kind of new. But, I mean, Chapter 6 is all special cases of black holes. It's, you know, the spinning black hole, the charged black hole, the spinning charged black holes, and, you know, some of the implications that fall from that. When you get to Chapter 7, linearized general relativity, it basically means here's a simpler way of doing the stuff that you've already seen. And it'll get us into gravitational waves. And so, at a minimum, I'm hoping to cover, you know, talk a little bit about linearized gravity and talk about gravitational waves. And I don't think I'm going to have time to go into stuff about the production of gravitational waves and the energy loss of gravitational waves, which is all really interesting stuff, but, you know, unfortunately, that's what happens.
Does that mean that the final will sort of only be on the things you've talked about?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, it'll be things I talked about or things that you can derive from the stuff I talked about. So I'll go through what's going to be on the final, and I'll give you that next week to start looking at. But and hopefully I'll have the actually gone through and decided exactly what I can cover on the notes in that time. And then the final won't be due until after the last class. But, and then you look at Chapter 8, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff in Chapter 8. You've already heard a lot about the maximally symmetric universes and cosmology, but I would go through the, you know, some of the Robinson-Walker solutions, Friedman stuff, which is the cosmology stuff I usually think of when I think of cosmology. And then there's some interesting stuff here on gravitational lensing, which is something that's good to know about. And then there's also other stuff on our universe and inflation and things like that, which, again, it's kind of a wish list of stuff to go over, but it's not going to happen. Because if you look at from the beginning of Chapter 7 to the end of Chapter 8, that's 100 pages. And obviously I'm not going to go over 100 pages in two lectures. I think with the way I do my notes, typically one of these classes I'm covering about 10 pages of my notes, which is around 25 pages in the book, maybe. So,
4 nights, we only have 2 nights.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that maybe I can cover about 60 pages out of that 100. Try to hit the most important stuff. But the stuff that I'm not going to cover is going to be stuff that you could read and understand yourself. Okay. So today we're actually going to start talking officially about black holes, because we talked a lot about the Schwarzschild solution. And this is just basically just taking it a step further. And so the whole idea of the Schwarzschild solution was for it to apply to the curvature of space-time outside of a gravitating body, and using the Earth or the Sun as a gravitational body. So the idea is, last time we talked about geodesics in the Schwarzschild space-time, and now we're going to actually talk specifically about what happens when you get too close to one of these things. And so we're going to look at the causal structure, and you get the causal structure by looking at a null or light-like vector traveling into the space-time, where here ds squared is equal to 0, but they also took d theta and d phi equal to 0, meaning that you're just coming straight in. You're not spinning around. And so when you do that, you're just left with the t and r parts of the metric, and you can just simply divide through, and you get dt dr equals this. And you could see that if you take the radius and you go out to infinity, where you get asymptotically flat space-time, The second term
disappears,
and you're just left with 1. So DTDR just goes to 1, which is just like
a normal light cone. You know, the change in time and change in position are equivalent to each other.
But as you get to R equals 2GM, what happens is you have 1 minus 1, and you have 1 over 0, which is infinity. And that means DTDR goes to infinity.
And if DTDR goes to infinity, if you could kind of picture a light cone in your mind, and you got that one axis with the time and the other axis with space, DTDR is like the slope of the line between the two. So DTDR equals 1 is that 45 degree angle. What happens if it goes to infinity? That means you're at an infinite slope, which means that it goes literally straight up and down. So the light cone collapses into, you know, just a straight vertical line. And so what this means to us is that the light appears to get to, or never appears to get to the R equals 2GM. It comes close and keeps getting closer and closer and closer and closer, but it never quite gets there. And it's as if it just kind of slows down. And so if you're an infalling observer,
so if we take the reciprocal of dtdr, we get drdt.
Right, which means the speed of light basically stops. The speed of light goes to 0. Yeah, which is really weird to see. And so if an infalling observer approaches this R equals 2GM, then any time interval, delta tau, and their proper time is going to correspond to a longer observed time interval for an outside observer as they see them approaching. So in other words, for you, you know, your clock, your watch is kind of ticking along normally, and you know, you're just thinking, okay, I'm falling in this thing and nothing big is going on. But to somebody on the outside, they look at you and you look like you're frozen. Looks like you're not moving. And the closer you get to the horizon, the more you'll slow down. And you'll just get slower and slower and slower and eventually just kind of stop. So what that means is that it takes an observer, it just seems to take this observer forever to actually get in there. So the question is, does an observer reach R equals 2GM in a finite amount of proper time?
Probably not.
Well, I think you got two different arguments here. You got the outside observer's position and the inside observer's position. So we have to kind of correlate what's really happening. One guy says yes, and the other guy says no. Then the answer is Schrodinger's cat is dead. What?
So, you know, it's kind of like you have to be in one of these two situations. Either it's infinite or it's not. So the way we do this is we're going to have to do some coordinate changes. And we're going to do a lot of coordinate changes in this area. First off, we can replace t with the coordinate that moves slowly on null geodesics. And so we're going to take t and make it into plus or minus r star plus some constant, where r star is defined by this equation here. So r star is equal to r plus 2gm and then a natural log of r over 2gm minus 1. And these are called Tortelese coordinates. And the idea here is that if you do a dt...
Like tortoise. Okay.
Yeah. Because yeah, I was thinking I had a, I was thinking that there was a, yeah. Yeah, kind of like an accent over one
French
of them.
Or something,
like
an A?
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe did they actually write it as tortoise in the book or tortoise?
I don't know. I don't remember spelling it as tortoise. Yeah.
Well, also, who knows how to pronounce
it? Yeah.
Shield, or... whatever.
Sports Shield?
Yeah, it grows me. I always think
or Sports Child. You know, people actually pronounce, some people pronounce it Sports Child, but I was always told it was Sports Shield.
I think that's because it doesn't have a T and it becomes the German SCH.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's a German word, so yeah. It's not supposed to. No. And this one, tortoise or tortellese, it just, I think I remember seeing it somewhere where it actually had the accent. And I don't remember if he did that in this book or not. Anyway.
Not in this book.
That's how we want a coordinate that moves slowly. So we need a turtle.
Oh, with a French accent to make it a French tortoise.
Yeah. Anyway, so if you could see here that if you do DTDR, this should come out the same as you know what you would get before, but this R star is it's the coordinate R, and everything here depends on radial coordinates. So it's still a radial coordinate. And if you take R greater than 2GM, then you can see R is greater than 2GM. This number inside a natural log is positive. And so you, and as you take this out, you get this up to the right level, the natural log disappears and you just have the radius R. So this can actually become the same thing as radius R at some points. And so you can see that it's physically relevant that the two R's are related, R star and R. Now, we can actually use this new coordinate, and you can do dr, dr star, and you can replace the dr with the dr star in the metric. And when you do that, you can rewrite your metric like this, where you can see now that the time and space, or the R part of the metric, are both have the same term in front of them. So those metric terms are now the same for the space-time. And then the angular parts are just sitting here on the end. They're really not affected here. And I mean, you almost have to just kind of do this derivative in your head, but you can see when you take the derivative of the natural log, what happens is you you divide through by the 2GM, and then you have the natural log term. When you take that derivative, you end up getting a 1 over this whole thing, which is going to be the 1 minus m over r. So it works out pretty well. And you'll notice here, now, as r goes to 2gm, what happens is the metric terms here just go to 0, both of them. So one doesn't go to infinity, the other one that doesn't go to 0, they both go to 0. So it's not infinite, which is good. And you can see that R star, when you do that, it's going to go to minus infinity at 2GM. And the reason why is because you could see that as R goes to 2GM, you've got 1 minus 1, the natural log. And the natural log of 0 is minus infinity. So that's going to dominate and cause the whole R star to go to minus infinity. Now, you can use this R star, and you can combine it with the time coordinate, and you get what we call the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. Eddington-Finkelstein. And there's two of them. There is the infalling or ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinate, and then there's the outgoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And the reason why we use these is because in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, you remember what we said before, that 2GM was a coordinate singularity, and it was different than a real essential singularity. And basically, the Eddington-Finkelstein gets rid of that singularity and allows us to do calculations across the horizon without having any problem. So if I write the metric in terms of the infalling or ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, then you get something like this, where you have the dv squared term. It's like your timeline term. And then there's these cross terms between the radial and the timeline, and the
adding to Finkelstein coordinates, and then there's the Ayo coordinates.
And when you take the determinant of the metric, you end up just getting r to the 4 sine squared theta, which is invertible, and it doesn't change at 2gm. So the determinant of the metric doesn't blow up. It doesn't even necessarily drop to zero. And that's good mathematically.
And you said that Edelston
Finkelstein? Eddington-Finkelstein.
Eddington-Finkelstein allows you to do what? Across the...
Oh, you can just do calculations right across the horizon.
Horizon at the edge of the black hole?
Yeah, at the 2GM.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's almost like 2GM is just nothing special.
Oh, across the singularity, in other words?
Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because at 2GM, this term right here, this first term that's time-like, disappears. But you still have these two.
Okay.
And
oh,
so
okay.
They keep the metric from becoming singular.
Okay.
Because they don't blow up. The only way this blows up is at r equals zero, because then this term becomes infinite. And we know there's a singularity at r equals zero. And so...
The metric equation has got dv, but it doesn't have du in it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's because we're only using the ingoing Eddington Finkelstein here. And so you'll notice here that dv dr, if you go into the black hole, it's going to give you zero. And outgoing, if you go the other way, it's going to give you 1 minus 2gm over r. And so what happens
is r approaches 2gm.
Right.
So you still have the singularity there.
Yeah. But actually the as r equals 2gm, it goes to infinity for outgoing. But for infalling, it's zero, which is fine. Yeah. And so what happens is you can think of this where what this is basically saying is if you're falling into the black hole, and they describe it here, that in this coordinate system, the light cones are well behaved at 2GM, and all they really do is they just turn. So out here at infinity, you've got a regular light cone. As you fall towards it, then the light cone kind of tips over, and it falls. And when it hits this 2GM, it just tipped at a 45-degree angle. And then as it falls in, it kind of tips even more, and the light cone, closes up. But it doesn't close up at that 2GM. It doesn't close up to get to infinity, or at zero. And then at zero, that's where this thing is going to blow up, because you've got a singularity there. And so this is interesting because you have light cones that tip over, but they don't blow up at that coordinate singularity. And so you can follow a future-directed light cone safely. And the way they say it is, all future-directed paths are in the direction of decreasing r, as you can see here. So if you want to go towards the future, you're going to go towards singularity.
Both in the past and the black hole?
No. Well, what happens is when the light cone tips over, one way you can think about that is that space and time are starting to switch. And your time...
In one direction in space and time.
Yeah, time is becoming space-like. And space is becoming time-like. And when you hit that singularity, you're completely flipped over. So weird things happen. What's interesting, when we get to the more advanced black holes, you can actually see there's some where they have two horizons, where you'll fall in and the horizon will flip and time and space will change each other, and you reach a certain point and they'll flip back. And so you get into this really interesting thing where, literally, space ends up looking like time. Since you can't control the direction of time, you can't control the direction of space. So the event horizon is basically the point of no return that you fall into.
And what's that R221?
R2.
After figure 5.10.
Oh, page 221. That was just a note to myself.
Okay. You have trouble finding figure 5.10.
Yeah. Yeah, but what happens here is that one way that this is described when I say the event horizon is that the escape velocity is equal to the square root of 2gm over r. And so what happens, this is the gravitational escape velocity. And so what happens is when escape velocity equals 1, it's effectively the speed of light. So when you're outside of the black hole and r is greater than 2gm, let's say it's 8gm, then that means that the escape velocity would only be half the speed of light. As you cross the threshold and r is equal to 2gm, then the escape velocity is equal to 1, or the speed of light. And then when you get inside the black hole, then it becomes greater than the speed of light. And so you reach a point where you can't get out unless you're moving faster than the speed of light, and you can't move faster than the speed of light because Einstein says you can't.
Unless you're moving back in time.
Yeah. And if you can go back in time, the first thing you do is not fall into the black hole.
Yeah.
So that becomes a problem. And, you know, that's why, you know, they say you need some theoretical particle like a tachyon going faster than the speed of light.
Go
backwards in time.
B equals 1 at r equals 2.
Right, and 1 is the speed of light in this case. And so a black hole, which I think it was Wheeler who coined the phrase, is basically something where a light cannot escape because it's gone into this event horizon. And so in order to have a black hole, all the mass has to be inside this event horizon, because if it's not, then you can never actually get to the event horizon because there's mass in the way.
Actually, the light can't escape because I've got lap lost in the past.
Well, that's another way to look at it. But I'd say it is, you know, you could think of it as light doesn't have enough escape velocity to get out. You could think of it as it can't go backwards in time at this point because it's stuck going in this time-like direction, and no light curve won't ever find its way. But however you want to look at it, the point is it's black because no light's ever going to escape from it.
Well, at that point, the null geodesic would be in a circle around the black hole.
Inside.
At the event horizon.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing, too, is that, like, in Newtonian gravity, that would never happen. But here, you can actually get that, where you can actually have a trapped light, like you said, and it happens right at that event horizon. Kind of like what we talked about last time, when you have this picture.
Yeah.
And so at 2GM, where this collapsed, you have light that kind of falls in and can actually be trapped and move in a circle. And so the neat thing is that there is this event horizon, which happens here at 2GM in a Schwarzschild black hole, actually separates everything on the outside of the universe from the singularity that occurs at r equals 0. And if it wasn't for that, then, you know, and the black hole is basically that region which separates the event horizon from the singularity. And that's what keeps us from seeing what they call a naked singularity. A naked singularity would be if there was just a singularity right there.
At r equals 0?
Yeah, but without a horizon around it. In other words, when you're walking along, minding your own business, and next thing you know, there's a space-time singularity. You know, it'd be kind of uncomfortable. You need some kind of warning that you're running into one. And that's what the event horizon does.
Well, the event horizon is kind of a singularity, too.
Yeah, it's a coordinate singularity, though.
It's the
it's
one.
A, It's the warning.
It's the warning singularity, or the real singularity.
Yeah, it's the warning singularity. It's the do not enter here sign. How can I make this more clear?
Well, we can't see beyond the event horizon.
Well, yeah, if you look over and you see something and the light won't escape from it, then don't go in there.
It's like we have this problem with all this radioactive material, and in 100,000 years, people won't know where the radioactive stockpiles are. We need little mini black holes.
Shooting into a black hole.
Anyway, so the idea is that, that's what the purpose of the event horizon is. It keeps us kind of shielded. And so we have this thing called a maximally extended Schwarzschild solution, and this is in the next section, where, I just have a little note here, if you decrease the radius along the radial null curve, you get V is equal to a constant, and which basically says that T plus R star is constant. And you're just changing the two of them at the same rate, which makes sense because that basically means, that if V is a constant, that means dV basically just drops out. So a local observer will not notice that he's crossed the event horizon because, nothing has really changed for them. They won't really know they crossed the event horizon until they decide, oh, this is nice, it's time to leave. And that's when they run into a problem. So, in the VR coordinate system, we can cross the event horizon in a future-directed path, but not a past-directed path. In other words, the physics of it works fine as long as you're just trying to look towards the future. If you try to go towards the past and move things backwards, it doesn't seem to work very well. Now, if you use U instead of V, then this is the outgoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinate system. And you get this metric, which looks very similar. The difference is very slight. You see this is plus for the ingoing, and then the cross terms are minus here. But otherwise they look the same mathematically. And so if you look at this figure, you could see this is the outgoing Eddington-Finkelstein, and you could see here it's the same thing that we saw before, only everything is flipped around. So now the cone is tipping the other way, as if its time is running backwards and it's kind of, you're leaving the black hole instead of coming in, as opposed to this picture. Yeah. So if you just say, wait a minute, I want the outgoing, I picked the wrong one, then that's how you get out of it. And so you can only pass through the event horizon on a past-directed path in that case. And so to keep V equal constant and decrease R as T goes to infinity, you would, with the outgoing Eddington-Finkelstein, you keep U equals constant and decrease R as T goes to minus infinity. So in other words, at minus infinity, you were in the black hole, and then you kind of move along this constant U path, and that'll take you out. So we've extended space-time into the future and the past across the event horizon by using these Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates.
And the past is the outgoing, and the future is the infalling.
Right. And if you use both U and V, then you get this metric, where you can see it's now, you've just got cross terms in here. And
is that a minus EVU plus
function? Oh, this?
Yeah.
Leads.
No, below that.
Oh.
Under the word DS, there's a minus D.
Oh, minus 1/2.
Go the next term. Go to the next term.
Oh, this?
No, the next term.
Is that minus a minus D?
No. No, that's just a smudge.
Okay.
That's just DV, DU. Well, remember, these metrics have to be symmetric. So you can kind of look at it and see that if this were minus,
then there would be an anti-symmetry between dv/du, which it wouldn't work. So if you do this, R is defined in terms of the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. If you take 1 half times V minus U, that should be R plus 2GM natural log of all this other stuff. Because this is effectively R star.
Natural log parties?
Oh, the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
Remember, this was the definition of R star with all this stuff.
Okay.
From this. So R equals 2GM implies then that either V is equal to minus infinity or U is equal to plus infinity. Because, you know, if R is equal to 2GM, remember this goes to minus infinity. And the only way it can go to minus infinity is if either V is minus infinity or U is plus infinity. And you see that other minus sign in front. So what they do is they do another coordinate change. And this other coordinate change changes to V prime and U prime, where V prime is equal to the exponential e to the V, and they put in a 4GM, and the U prime is equal to exponential minus U over 4GM. And the idea is that if this goes to minus infinity, then V prime will go to zero. And if this goes to infinity for U, then now U prime will go to go to 1, because that would be exponential of, that would go to 0, because it would be exponential of minus infinity. And you could see that you can kind of take that and propagate it across and see what that says for in terms of R and T. And you can see that R and T now are equal to, tells you that this has got to be true. And so you can see that here I've just taken R star and broken it up into R plus T. Kind of like if you have from before, V is equal to T plus R star and U is equal to T minus R star. And all we've done here is taken R star and T and kind of gone back to our original coordinates and wrote the new coordinates in terms of the old coordinates. Then, if you've got U prime and V prime, you can write the metric again in terms of those two. So you can see that this is the new metric in terms of V prime and U prime. And so the idea here is that now you got something really interesting, because as R goes to 2GM, this is just a number. It doesn't even blow up or anything. Or go to 0. Yeah. E to the minus 1. And this term obviously doesn't disappear. So you just have a metric, and it looks pretty well behaved. And you could see then, only at R equals 0 does this thing really have a problem. As R goes to infinity, then, of course, this whole thing goes to 0, which is still not the worst thing in the world. But, this will go to 0, and this will go to 0, so we actually really think about what happens in that limit. But the idea is that, you know, it's well-behaved at that singularity. And so if you take V prime and U prime, and they're null coordinates, basically they would be the lines that light would be moving along. And you can kind of say they're null coordinates because if you take, let's say you take ds squared equal to 0 for like a null vector, then you see these are cross terms, or the only things that are going to survive. And it, basically what it tells you is that they must be, you know, they're the path that the light would travel on. So the partial derivative with respect to V prime and the partial derivative with respect to U prime are going to be null vectors. Kind of like if you take X that's a coordinate. You take a derivative with respect to x, then that gives you a direction that the derivative is going to be moving in, or the gradient is going to be, or whatever. So these are actually null vectors. And so...
Is that partial dr or d mu and nu?
V and u. Yeah. This one is a v.
First one's a v.
Yeah, and the second one is a u. That's u. It's v. All right, and so you have now two other coordinates you can make out of this. One is a time-like vector, which comes from having t equal to 1/2 v prime plus u prime. And then in that, you know, of course, you can write it out in terms of all the other stuff. And you notice this gives you a hyperbolic sine term. And then the other one comes from comes from v prime minus u prime, which gives you this, which is a cosh, hyperbolic cosine. And so t, in this case, is a time-like vector, and r is a space-like vector. Because, you know, v and u represent these directions that the light's going on, then by finding the sums or differences of them, you can get the time-like or space-like vector. And it's kind of like you have to picture a space-time diagram with this. So if this is your time-like direction, and this is your spatial direction, or I should say R and capital T, and then you have a vector like this and a vector like that, then this one might be V, and this one might be U. And then you could see that if you sum the two of them together, you know, summing vectors, you end up getting something that just points in this direction. Find the differences between them, get something in the radial direction. So that's another geometric way of kind of looking at how that happens. And so after you do this coordinate change, then you can, you know, rewrite the metric, and you can see here clearly, this looks like a time-like vector, and this looks like a spatial vector. And then your angular are just out here hanging in the air. And so if you look at the difference between t squared and r squared, you can kind of get back. I mean, you can see from looking at these two, t squared minus r squared, you can kind of get back to a definition of what r is. And you can, you know, you can also do other manipulations on them and get to the definition of time back from these guys, if you wanted to. And so what happens is we use TR, theta, and phi, and what we call Kruskal coordinates. And you can see with T and R here, the nice thing about this is, again, it's well behaved at the singularity.
At the event horizon. And so if T is equal to R plus or minus R plus a constant, then the event horizon is going to be defined by T equals plus or minus R. And if we could say that if the radius is constant, then T squared minus R squared is a constant. If the radius, if time is constant, then we can get that from looking at the ratio of these two, and we end up getting like something like a hyperbolic tangent describing time. Is if time goes to plus or minus infinity, T over R goes to plus or minus 1. Therefore, time plus or minus infinity is also a horizon, just like R equals 2gm. Because, you know, everything kind of goes like that.
What's the word in front of horizon?
The horizon.
Oh, the horizon, okay.
Oh.
That's all right.
Yeah, I don't know why I put A, B.
That's all right. As long as it's not something else.
Yeah, Microsoft didn't quite check that one. So, as you take, as long as R is not equal to 0, all the values of T and R are allowed. So basically what they've done is they've created a metric that works pretty smoothly through all the different regimes.
Which makes sense if you go back to the idea of a manifold. The idea of a manifold was that we could always map it and have a continuous map explaining the manifold. And so what this does is it basically is creating a continuous map. And so you can see that R goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, and t squared is always going to be less than r squared plus 1. And so if you look at this thing called a Kruskal diagram, it looks like this, where you can see that you've got all these four different regions here. Out here, you've got r going out to infinity. This one you have t going up to infinity. And then this line here represents time going to plus infinity and r is equal to 2gm. So this is like looking at the horizon. Down here is r is equal to 2gm and time goes to minus infinity. And that goes like this. And so, and then you have these areas like this, which are constant r. This is constant time. Sorry, get that wrong. Oh, sorry, these are constant time. This is constant r. And then this is r equals 0, the singularity there. And so what happens is you can kind of look at it as you're from going from r equals infinity and you're moving along and eventually you're at some time up here. And so you can kind of draw what's going on as you're on your way to the singularity. You might follow a path like that. And so all the light cones here are at 45 degrees. And so what the way they do it is they break it down into four regions where each one of these regions is going to tell you a little bit about the space-time. So in region one, you've got R universe. So this is R is greater than 2GM out here. Region two is our future. Like if you're falling into the black hole, this is where you're going to fall into. So you can imagine a line just going from region one to region two, and eventually you hit that singularity. Region three is the past. So it's sort of like if you were in the black hole in the past, then that's where you would be. And then region four is like another space-time out here. So sort of like some alternate universe, that's where it would be. And you can't go from region 1 to region 4, because if you go from region 1, you cross through here, you end up going into the black hole. But you can go from region 4, or region 3, which is the past, into region 4, for example. And we're going to see this again when we talk about the spinning black holes and the spinning charged black holes, because that's when you get to some really interesting stuff like that. So all the future-directed paths go from region 1 to region 2 and end up inside the black hole. In other words, you're doomed. And inside of that, R becomes time-like and T becomes space-like. So space and time flip each other. And the tidal forces are going to rip you apart before you actually get in there, so you don't even have to worry about much. And you'll never escape. But again, on the positive side, you'll be already ripped apart, so you won't really care.
That was by the way?
Yeah, that was a by the way. Just something you know about. This is why there are all these, you know, horizons around these singularities, so you don't accidentally fall into one. Region 3 is the time reverse of region 2. And it's called a white hole. Yeah. And so there's a singularity in the past. There's nothing you can enter, but stuff can leave. And it's sort of like it's like a reverse black hole, a white hole. Stuff can just shoot out of it. And region 4 is the parallel universe is correct, not connected to region 1. But the idea is if you had an Einstein-Rosen bridge, then you could actually go through this black hole, come out this side, and into an alternate universe or into somewhere else in the universe. And the Einstein-Rosen bridge is kind of described down here, where you might have these two singularities that form. They somehow get linked up through space-time, and then you have this connection between the two. And then it goes unstable and falls apart. What it always does on Star Trek, anyway. So, the idea is that you get into some really interesting stuff. We also have these things called conformal or Penrose diagrams, which look like this, where this is another drawing where this is known as spatial infinity out here. So this is the edge of the universe. And here's the singularity at r equals zero. These lines here represent the horizon. So what happens in this conformal diagram is you're out here happily living your life. If you go out to this way, this is the edge of the universe. This is the farthest, furthest away you can go from the black hole. You're falling in, and you cross through here, and you're in a singularity. And then the white hole sets things up to the alternative universe. And so these are also useful for studying space-time. Here's my crude drawing of one of these things. And so I labeled it I, which is up here, is future infinity. I minus is past infinity. I naught is spatial infinity. And then you've got the future null infinity and the past null infinities and all these other things. And so these conformal diagrams can be really useful for studying astrophysics and cosmology, because like this is a conformal diagram showing the collapse of a star into a black hole, where you could see that you have this singularity that's kind of forming here and opening up. And here's the mass of the black hole, or mass of the star before it becomes a black hole. See, this is R equals zero singularity. And so you can describe the process of a stellar collapse by looking at this. And but you need to also look at the spherically symmetric non-vacuum solutions to Einstein's equations in order to make this work. So you'd actually have to put in something like this onto the right-hand side of Einstein's equation. So you have a non-zero stress-energy tensor, and then solve all the equations all the way through as it collapsed down. And then that also leads you to the idea of what they call a Schwarzschild mass. Where the Schwarzschild mass, and I think that's just a little smudge, you know, it's just the capital M here, is where you basically look at the radius, the mass is a function of radius of a star, and you integrate over the density of the star over the entire, over the radius. And to get to the true energy density, what happens is, this is just a simple integral of density, you know, where you're just
integrating
of mass density or whatever fluid density. This is the true energy density. You notice the difference between these two is that while this one used just basically took spherical symmetric, just integrate, just like you normally would in spherical symmetry, and the density is a function of radius. Here, you're integrating over space-time curvature.
What's gamma?
Gamma is the metric of the hypersurface. So in other words, if you look at the spatial part of the space-time metric, like let's say ds squared is equal to gij dxi dxj. Okay? Well, if we take out the time parts, then we would write this as
G00 BT squared plus gamma IJ, IJ, something like that.
So here I've kind of separated out time. Then this is the three metric, which is the metric that describes the spatial parts alone. And so that is what we're using in the integral. So what this is doing is it's actually taking into account the curvature of the space-time into the collapse. So you get the energy not only of the mass density, but the energy of the curvature, all that gravitational energy. And so you end up getting something like this in your integral, if you're assuming a Schwarzschild space-time. And so the binding energy is the difference between these two. So you have the true energy density, which is the energy of the space-time curvature and the mass density of everything. And then you have the Schwarzschild mass, which is just the energy of the the star by itself, the density of it. And the difference between those is the binding energy, which is always positive, which means that there's some positive amount of energy that just comes from that curvature of the space-time. Now, dPdr is the hydrostatic equilibrium equation, also known as the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. And it's given here. It's not really something I talk about, I'm going to talk about much here, but the idea of this equation is that it's going to describe how pressure changes with radius. And so what that does is it kind of gives you a model for understanding the equation of state. Well, if you know the equation of state, which is the relationship between density and pressure, then you can solve this equation, and then what happens is stars have to reach a certain hydrostatic equilibrium where the gravitational pressure pushing it in is going to be equal to the fluid pressure pushing it out. And so in most stars, what happens is, you try to compress a fluid, it won't compress, and then also if it's hot, then there's radiation pressure, and then there's electromagnetic pressure coming from all the charged particles that don't want to squeeze together. And so if you want to collapse into a black hole, you got to overcome all of that. And so what happens is first you overcome the fluid pressure, and then you have to overcome, at some point you overcome the electromagnetic pressure, which is keeping electrons and protons, from merging together into neutrons. And then after all that, you have a neutron star, and to collapse that further, you've got to overcome the electric degeneracy pressure, which is quantum mechanical force. It's just kind of keeping it apart. And then once you've done all that, that's when you collapse into a black hole. And so to calculate this, you need to know this equation of state, and usually that is the gamma law equation of state, where we say that if you take rho to some gamma, then that gives you pressure.
That Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation looks like it has two singularities, at R equals 2GM and R equals 0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but remember that that's where the pressure would go to infinity. Because the thing about this is that, like, as soon as you can actually get the entire mass of a star inside of its event horizon, then it runs away and collapses to a black hole. So that's where that one singularity is coming from. In which case, this physics just breaks down when you're inside that horizon. And then R equals zero, obviously that means you're dealing with a point singularity. That doesn't really work. So yeah, you're right. It does sort of do that, but that just kind of means, you have to see what happens there. And so you can actually, from that, you can actually calculate exactly what the critical masses are going to be in order to collapse into these black holes or neutron stars. And so if you assume a constant density star, which never happens, then
for rho of R, you could say that you have the density of rho star inside of the radius, and outside it just goes to zero. Then the Schwarzschild mass is just going to be equal to this, where you could say inside of the radius, this is going to go to 4/3 pi r cubed times the density. Outside, it's just going to be just the total radius. And then you can find your pressure as a function of density by just doing this.
And so if the mass of the star exceeds this maximum mass, then the central pressure is going to be greater than infinite. It's just going to blow up. They say greater than infinite, but that really doesn't make much sense. And you can see how that can blow up here by just kind of following these equations and seeing where that thing just blows up to infinity. And so there are no static solutions in general relativity, and star collapses eventually, forming a black hole. And so there's this thing called Bashutel's theorem, which says that there are no static solutions exist unless the mass is less than some critical amount. And the idea is that if the mass is greater than this critical amount, eventually it's going to collapse into a black hole. And if it's less than this amount, then it's not enough mass for it to collapse into a black hole, so it can be static, and it'll actually, even when the star dies, it'll continue to exist.
Is that 4R over 9G?
Yeah, 4R over 9G. And we also have this thing called the Chandrasekhar limit, where if an object has a mass above 1.4 solar masses, it can collapse into a neutron star. And that's where you've overcome everything except for the neutron fermion degeneracy pressure. The Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit is where you actually collapse into a black hole, and that's somewhere between 3 and 4 solar masses. I think it's better defined now. And the last thing I want to talk about, and this is actually coming from the beginning of chapter 6, and it was something he called the black hole zoo. And the idea here is that, you know, we're talking about a basic black hole, but, and that's just in the spherically symmetric case. If you do the non-spherically symmetric case, there's an unlimited number of possible fields that you can run into, unlimited number of black holes. And we have this thing called a no-hair theorem, which basically says that if you start off with anything that's going to collapse down into a black hole, then the solutions of the general relativity coupled with the electromagnetism that are non-singular outside the event horizon, doesn't matter what happens, are going to be once it collapses into a black hole, you can completely characterize any black hole by its mass, its electric and magnetic charge, and its angular momentum. No matter what kind of fields were present. In other words, just like all electrons look alike, all black holes essentially look alike, except for, you know, these three characteristics you can, assign to them. And that there's really nothing else in there. It's all the information that was outside of these black holes just disappeared. And so if the no-hair theorem wasn't true, what this says is that you would need an infinite number of multipoles to describe gravitational fields from any non-symmetric black hole. And no matter how complex the initial conditions, the final black hole is always going to be the same. So, in other words, the only things you need to know for studying black holes is, first off, is it spherically symmetric or not? If it is, then it's a Schwarzschild black hole. If it has angular momentum
what's its mass and what's its charges. Does it have a magnetic field? That's all you need to know. And so what we do in Chapter 6 is we're basically going to just focus on looking at black holes with these three, or in terms of these three properties, and then we can know everything there is to know about them, in theory. Okay. All right, so any questions?
Magnetic charge?
Mm-hmm. Or magnetic field?
Magnetic monopoles?
Basically, you know, just kind of like a star has a magnetic field, black hole have a magnetic field. Same thing. I mean, they don't mean it like a magnetic monopole or anything like that, but...
So a dipole?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But pretty much, if you're talking about a black hole, I don't think you can even get higher than a dipole. I don't think you can have a magnetic quadrupole in a black hole, because then that would imply some kind of structure to it. It doesn't allow that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and actually when I was in grad school, we came up, we wrote a paper where we looked at how you can actually use gravitational wave detectors in order to test the no-Hare theorem and to identify these different characteristics of a black hole. Like, you can actually take a black hole and study it with a gravitational wave detector. And what happens with these gravitational waves is that they... It's like hitting a bell, and a bell rings, but it doesn't ring with just one perfect frequency. It rings with several frequencies.
Harmonics.
With all the harmonics. And based on these harmonics, you can tell things about what's the mass of the black hole and its angular momentum. And you can show that one signal that you're getting, if it comes from one black hole or two different ones or whatever. Okay. All right. So I'll see you guys next time.